May it please the court.
You may proceed.
Ms. Churchill was charged with perjury for statements that she made at a protective custody hearing. The juvenile petition alleged that Ms. Churchill had abused and neglected her child, and she was subpoenaed the day before the hearing to give testimony and to bring the child to the hearing. When she arrived at the hearing, she immediately requested counsel, and she repeatedly requested counsel throughout the hearing. And although counsel is required by both statute and rule, her valid request was denied by the judge, who in his previous capacity as a juvenile officer had terminated Ms. Churchill's parental rights to three other children. And while it's also clear that her testimony could have exposed her to revealing incriminating information because she had been charged with abuse and neglect, no one at that hearing advised her of her Fifth Amendment rights, her privilege, or informed her, as an attorney would have, that she had a right not to answer their questions. Instead, she was forced to take the stand, uncounseled and unwarned. In this coercive environment, she denied the existence of the child and was charged with perjury. And we have alleged in this appeal that her statement should have been suppressed. Now, the reason this case was transferred is that there was a critical distinction between, in the Eastern District, between the majority opinion and the dissenting opinion on what standards should be followed in terms of perjured testimony and how it relates to the Fifth Amendment privilege. The majority opinion followed federal cases of U.S. versus Mondwano and Wong, and seemed to impose a bright line test that under no circumstances would perjured testimony be excluded pursuant to a Fifth Amendment privilege or a due process analysis. The dissent disagreed and stated that because under these circumstances she was denied her right to counsel after repeatedly requesting counsel by a judge who had previously taken her children away, she was promised that this would be a temporary matter only. She was given no warning and no notice, although the state and the judge were fully aware that she was subjected to giving incriminating testimony. Under those circumstances, her testimony, her statement made as it related to the questions asked, should have been suppressed as involuntary in violation of her due process rights. So we have the dissent who believes that it was involuntary and should have been suppressed, and we have the majority opinion who believed that under Mondwano and Wong, under no circumstances could perjured testimony be excluded.
The dissent doesn't cite any law in support of the dissenting judge's position, while the majority cites pretty extensive law that even if an individual's constitutional rights are violated, that does not excuse them giving perjured testimony. So help us. I know it's in your brief, but what is your best legal argument for that counters the state's position?
The dissent was brief, and it may have been my failure to adequately argue it in the brief below. It may have been my failure to argue the case below. But certainly, our stand is that there is Missouri precedent for excluding the statement, and that's State versus Caperton. It's a decision out of this court in 1918. It's an oldie but a goodie. And it required that a defendant who was summoned before a grand jury without counsel, without being advised of his rights, made a perjured statement, this court held that had to be excluded as involuntary. And I think that's the distinction let's remember, Mondwano was a plurality opinion. Many opinions were written in that case. But two of the most important concurring opinions in Mondwano specifically stated that the defendant's answers at that grand jury setting were not induced by governmental tactics or procedures that were so inherently unfair as to constitute a violation of due process. Another justice pointed out that this is not a case where it could plausibly be argued that the perjury prosecution should be barred because of prosecutorial misconduct. In both of those cases, the defendants had counsel and were given warnings. And in fact, it may be the case that a grand jury case never comes before the United States Supreme Court again because as a matter at least in the federal context, a federal grand jury, because the Attorney General's office requires witnesses to be warned of their privilege against self-incrimination. So,
now, is that your argument, or is it that she had a right to counsel, and counsel would have warned her?
I think we look at the totality of the circumstances she was facing at that hearing. And one of those circumstances is that she was denied her absolute right to counsel by statute.
Well, which statute? That's where I get confused.
Section 211.
That says a party is entitled to be represented.
Correct.
So was she a party?
Yes.
The 211.132 says the court may make a parent a party. Did the court do that here?
The court believed that she was lying and that she was in fact the parent.
The court thought she was a witness. Where is it established that she was a party?
Well, she was alleged to be the mother of the child in the petition. So
right.
She was alleged by the state to be a party to
the whether or not she admitted it, you're saying the petition was the petition styled against the mother or against her name, or what is the petition styled?
It alleged both parents had abused and neglected the child.
It was a custody petition, though. It's a jurisdiction petition, right? It's not, she isn't a party. Her rights were not to be determined in that proceeding.
Well, she was certainly a putative party, and whether or not she was entitled to counsel, she was certainly a putative defendant who could have been charged for criminal criminal.
The right to counsel
attaches
to this order.
Correct.
Did the trial judge indicate she had a right to counsel?
Yes,
request for counsel, the trial court didn't say you're just a witness, you're not entitled to counsel.
No, he told her that she was entitled to counsel, but that they were going to go forward anyway, and that anything that happened that day would be a temporary matter. In fact, she had informed the court that she had contacted an attorney, but she couldn't yet make arrangements to have him there. So I think that
is there a time standard that required the judge to go ahead and have the hearing at that time?
Protective hearings have to be held within 3 days.
I apologize, I do not know the answer to that question. But I believe he ordered her by Monday to produce the child. So there was certainly a consideration that the hearing could be extended, at least to that date. And then 2 weeks later, she, after having spoken with counsel, or made arrangements to turn the child over. So really, it's that the fact that she was forced in this setting.
Would she have been entitled to an attorney that was paid for?
Yes.
In those proceedings?
You're entitled to appointed counsel, which I suppose contemplates that.
Was there some determination that she was indigent already?
I don't believe so. I think she would have qualified. Certainly under our standards, she qualified for appointed counsel.
When did she? She got notice just the day before, and she came in and said, I'm trying to get counsel. I haven't been able to get anyone. I don't want to answer your questions until I have counsel. And the judge said, you have a right to counsel, but I'm going to ask you these questions anyway now.
Yes, everyone acknowledged that she had a right to counsel, but that they were going to go as far as they could. They had taken testimony of two witnesses before she was called to the stand. They asked her if she wanted to cross-examine them, and she declined. They were family members.
They invited her to cross-examine?
Yes.
So the judge clearly thought she was a party if he invited
correct.
Her to cross-examine.
Well, he asked if she would like to ask any questions. So, yes, that contemplates that she's a party. And everyone assumed that she was entitled to counsel. And, in fact, I think the juvenile court judge testified in the criminal case that he knew she was entitled to counsel, but he wasn't going to stop under any circumstances at that time because they were trying to determine the location of the child.
What would have been sufficient in balancing those interests of a belief that there was a child that was abused and neglected that was being hidden, and her claiming she wants a right to counsel? What should the trial court have done in this case?
Well, I think what the trial judge did is sent a police officer out to the home to search the home and try to determine whether the child was located there.
Would it have been enough if the trial court had told her you have a right to remain silent. Anything you say can be used.
Absolutely. I mean, whether or not they could have gone forward on that day, had they at least advised her of her Fifth Amendment privilege not to make any statements, that would have been sufficient with or without counsel, is my position. That's why
for,
I believe
for the Fifth Amendment claim.
For the Fifth Amendment.
Not for the Sixth claim. Amendment claim.
Correct. And because she had not been charged, I don't believe a Sixth Amendment right had attached. My right to counsel argument stems from the 14th Amendment due process. She had a liberty interest in parenting her child. And under those circumstances, the U.S. Supreme Court says that you may be entitled to counsel. And indeed, that's probably why the legislature has required counsel in these cases. And I believe that State versus Caperton applies to this case. And when you are faced with a situation where the defendant is subject, or the putative defendant here, is subjected to the cruel trilemma of self-incrimination, perjury, or contempt, without a warning, without counsel, then any statement made should not be admitted in a later criminal trial. And I don't believe that the...
Every witness in every proceeding is subject to all of those same things. Are they all entitled to Miranda-type warnings before they take the stand?
Not necessarily, Your Honor. And that's why I think these are all very fact-specific cases. For instance, if in a criminal trial, and this happens routinely, a witness is called to the stand that the prosecutor or the defense attorney or someone believes may be subjected to self-incrimination, they give a warning. Now, there may... You know, they advise the witness before they testify that they don't have to testify or they have a right to consult with counsel before testifying. I think the important thing here is that the state and the judge here knew that she was subjecting herself to possibly making incriminating statements. That's not always the case. For instance, in the tax cases that have been cited in the briefs.
But she wasn't making incriminating statements until she made them. I mean, she was subjecting, she perjured herself. She didn't say something that was incriminating other than it was a lie under oath.
Right, but I think when the Fifth Amendment applies is when you're placed in a position where your answers could lead to could be a link in the chain to a prosecution against you. And certainly being asked the question whether she was the parent in an abuse and neglect situation would be a link in the chain to charging her with criminal penalties resulting from that alleged abuse and neglect.
But they haven't done that. They've only charged her.
Correct. She has
with
never been charged.
For lying on the stand.
She's never been charged criminally for any conduct relating to this child or any previous children.
If she had not asked for counsel, would we be here?
I believe so, because no one advised her of her right when she was in an incriminating situation. And
where would we draw the line then, when you need to advise and when you don't, if we were going to give the court's guidance as to when that needs to occur?
Well, under the statute, I don't believe she had to request counsel. I believe that she was entitled to counsel and the court had to provide it or ask her if she wanted counsel. So I don't think the burden is on her to ask.
Well, if we get back to that, then don't we have to get back to whether or not she was a party? And the only reason she has a statutory right to counsel is if she's a party.
I would agree with that. However, I believe everyone conducted that hearing believing she was a party. She is alleged to be the parent of the child, which makes her a party.
In juvenile proceedings, the parents are entitled to counsel. And parents are always
correct.
Entitled to counsel.
Even if they're not charged with abuse or neglect.
Is there a distinction with Caperton because it's grand jury proceeding versus a juvenile proceeding?
I don't believe so, because the Fifth Amendment applies in the criminal or civil context. The question is whether you are possibly subjected to criminal penalties based on the testimony you give, and those can arise in a civil proceeding.
Do you have to be in custodial interrogation for that to apply?
For Miranda warnings? For Miranda warnings, when those are required, and that's why the Manduano case didn't specifically address the question of whether the warnings had to be given. But before you're going to subject someone to possibly giving incriminating testimony, and they are without counsel, then I believe you do have to give at least the bare Fifth Amendment privilege allow her to know that she does not have to answer the questions.
So anytime a judge thinks someone's going to lie on the stand, do they have to stop and give them a warning that they have a right to remain silent?
No. And that's what makes it very important here, that the state and the juvenile officer knew that she was charged with abuse and neglect. Had she not been charged with any type of...
Wait a minute. She wasn't charged with...
I apologize. I'm a criminal attorney. I'm using that language. She was alleged... The child was alleged to have been abused and neglected.
Right, and that's it. Not that she did it.
But
the child had been abused and neglected and was under 17 is all that had to be shown.
Correct, but this judge also had terminated parental rights to three of her other children.
What is that?
He was well aware that he believed that the child existed and that she was the parent of the child. I don't think anyone ever...
But his beliefs are not evidence. He's got to have evidence of record to make those determinations. And and there was a dispute as to whether there was a child at all.
And two witnesses had testified that a child was in her custody and control before she took the stand.
And the judge's beliefs were based on court adjudication that her parental rights should be terminated.
But not in his role as a judge, but as
a prosecutor, or as a juvenile officer.
Correct.
I see my time.
Any further questions? Thank you, counsel. You'll have some time on rebuttal.
May it please the court.
You may proceed.
This is a unique juvenile case. The juvenile officer and the authorities believed that the defendant had a child in Illinois, brought the child back to Missouri, was hiding the child, and that the child was being abused or neglected.
Does that mean you don't have a right to counsel that you otherwise would have?
No, and...
I mean, I think we all understand why the judge wanted to get information, but that doesn't mean he can violate her rights and then hold her for perjury.
The proceeding was to determine, are you the parent of this child?
And are you saying the judge did correctly under the law when she said, I don't want to testify, I don't want to say anything until I get counsel, I invoke my right to counsel, and he said, that's fine, you have a right to counsel, you're going to answer these questions.
Yes, that was perfectly, it's
that's
just,
okay.
Like, any,
that's
just like any other civil case. If I'm summoned to appear in a civil case and I walk in without an attorney and demand an attorney, the judge can acknowledge the demand and be put on the stand and ask questions. And unless I order in an orderly fashion invoke my Fifth Amendment right not to incriminate myself, I can be asked questions just like any other witness in any civil proceeding. What occurred here, and it's the strange aspect of how these juvenile proceedings work at this particular stage. And this goes to Judge Wilson's question about, was she a party? The juvenile court didn't even know if she was a party yet, because there were these allegations and information that she may have...
If you take jurisdiction of someone's child, if she was, there were alleging she was the parent. If she was the parent, you are inherently a party. I mean, every juvenile custody determination, the parents, you're taking them from their jurisdiction, putting them in the jurisdiction of the court. They have a right to counsel under the juvenile statutes. You're saying she has to admit jurisdiction in order to have that right?
Well,
I mean, we don't do that in normal juvenile cases. You adjudicate that.
Well, Your Honor, they didn't know if she was the parent of this child. They knew there was this child. They didn't know if she was the parent. She was hiding the child. The evidence shows that she had an elaborate warning system at her house. She's hiding this child. They can't get to the child. If the authorities could have gotten to the child could have been taken into custody under judicial custody, and then the juvenile court could have issued a temporary custody order within 24 hours, and then within 3 days, you would have had this protective custody hearing. But because they didn't know, the court was trying to find out, do we even need to be here?
But didn't the trial judge even acknowledge that she was entitled to counsel?
Sure she wasn't. There's two...
So wouldn't she only be entitled if she was a party?
That is true, Your Honor. If she was not a party, then she would have no reason to be there, and those proceedings would have just evaporated.
But she was alleged to be a party at this point. Would you say that's fair?
Because that is fair, Your Honor, because they were trying to figure out, is she the parent of this child? Because she was telling people it was a grandchild.
So is the question then, if you're alleged to be a parent, then, or excuse me, if you're alleged to be the parent, then are you a party entitled to legal counsel?
That's right, Your Honor. And there's two prongs to this counsel.
Wait a minute. Before we go there, Judge Russell just asked a very important question. If being a parent makes you automatically a party, why do we have a statute that says the court may make a parent a party? That tends to indicate to me that not every parent is a party.
Well, if the juvenile officer in the petition hasn't named, because I think there's situations where with older juveniles where maybe they're not in the custody of a parent, and so when they're brought in before the juvenile court, the juvenile court can order the parent as a party, and you may have other children that
we're
are brought into the custody of the court that they don't know who the parents are.
But here they're alleging an infant in her custody, right?
That was an infant
who was in her custody.
That was the belief that she had a child, an infant, and was in her custody.
I mean, it sounds like until you prove the case, you don't get counsel. Until you prove you're a parent, which is part of what they're trying to prove, you don't get counsel. But shouldn't you have counsel to represent you in the course of that inquiry?
And that's what I was going with the there's two prongs of this counsel facet of this case. You are entitled to representation by counsel at all juvenile proceedings. It's sort of a tautology. You want to bring a lawyer, we're not going to stop you. The juvenile court has to allow you to bring a lawyer into any proceeding that you're involved in. That's one. The second is the right to appointed counsel upon a finding of indigency. That determination is made by statute, by this court's rules governing juvenile proceedings at the protective custody hearing. And many times, these are supposed to be informal matters, or at least treated that way, because people, parents, other people will show up without counsel. They've been summoned. These are essentially emergency hearings, because the policy of the state is to get these children under the state's protection as soon as possible. And the judge was right when he told Ms. Churchill, this is a temporary thing, because it is a temporary thing, because there's not just this temporary or this protective custody hearing, there's going to be an adjudication hearing, there's going to be a dispositional hearing, there's going to be multiple review hearings following all that.
But despite its informal nature, it's not on the record, true?
I'm sorry,
Your Honor. It's not on the record? The protective custody?
Well, it was recorded. We do have a recording of what occurred there.
But it's still under oath.
It is under oath. It is a judicial proceeding.
If she had exercised her right to remain silent, it would have been assumed that she admitted all those questions that were asked of her.
Well, I guess you could do that in a...
Well, you said it's just like any other civil proceeding. That's what I'm saying. So if she had been advised of a right to counsel and she had remained silent, the damage, if you will, would have been that her silence could have been used against her.
And what's the damage? She's the parent of a child. There's no crime. That's not a crime.
But if they asked her something else, would she be guilty of that, you presume? I mean, there's no limit. You're saying you can just continue to question someone when they've invoked their right to counsel, and you can draw inferences against them in the case without letting them get counsel?
You normally don't have the right to invoke counsel under the Sixth Amendment in a civil case.
This is a juvenile proceeding, and they're different. As you know, you do have rights to counsel you don't have if you're just testifying in a contract case. They're statutory.
Right, Your Honor. You have.
So it's not just like any civil case. It's a different case.
It is a little different because of this right to counsel aspect, but you're entitled to bring counsel with you. She chose not to. That's
well, no,
fine.
She didn't. She said she'd gotten notice the day before and she had not had time to get counsel and wanted counsel. That's different than going for weeks and weeks or months or having continuances and not bringing counsel. And even then, in a criminal case, we certainly question you about, do you understand that we're going to proceed? You've in effect volunteered not to go pro se because you haven't brought counsel. She had no time to get counsel.
Well, the juvenile court was required by law to hold this hearing within 3 days of the filing of the petition, and that was that day. This court's rules say there shall be no continuances of those hearings absent compelling, extenuating circumstances. Coming on and trying to delay the proceedings by saying, I want counsel, that's not going to delay those proceedings.
Well, it's a question of delaying her testimony, not delaying the proceedings. She demanded a right to counsel. What, and you're saying that can just be ignored because the court needed to hold the hearing, as opposed to continue without her testimony until she could get counsel?
Well, once she was there, they could ask her questions. She could have refused to answer the questions.
And then you're saying they could infer the answer against her, even though she'd had no time to get counsel.
And then that's the question.
Sort of a catch-22 here, isn't it?
But that's the question. What's the incriminating answer against her? Is this your child or not?
Well, maybe she needed counsel's advice to figure that out.
Can you discuss the application of Amanda Wano in this case?
Well, the United States Supreme Court is pretty uniformly held. You cannot use perjury as self-help against a perceived violation of your rights. She's not allowed, she believes she had the right to counsel. She's not allowed to remedy that by perjuring herself. And in Manduano, the defendant tries to distinguish it by saying, well, that person was warned. The very next term in United States against Wong, the witness in the grand jury proceeding claimed that they didn't understand the warning because of their limited control of the English language. And the court, in that case, said it doesn't matter whether you understood the warning or you didn't get warned. You're not allowed to perjure yourself.
But that person had counsel outside the grand jury room, right?
In Wong?
Yeah.
Yeah, possibly.
So that's the whole point here, is that she didn't.
But nowhere in those cases does the court say that having that counsel, having that right to counsel, or having counsel outside the room was the linchpin that made the case come out the way
it
did.
But you have no case like this where someone asked for counsel and didn't have it. There hasn't been a previous case.
No, Your Honor, because this is unique, because normally the child is already in the state's custody.
No, but I mean any perjury case, and I understand the principle about there's not a crime and there's not until you perjure yourself, but none of the ones you cited combined with someone asking for counsel to be advised about their testimony, that they then go ahead and give false testimony, and they're denied that counsel prior, and so then told they have to go ahead and testify. I mean, that's the point of counsel isn't it to explain these consequences more fully, and that's what she asked for.
Well, there were.
And in fact, she was told it was temporary. Do we know what she thought that meant?
Your Honor, this wasn't a criminal proceeding. It was a proceeding. The proceeding was all about to protect this child, not to prosecute this woman for any crime, not to dig up incriminating information on a crime. Ms. Churchill, do you have this child? Is this your child? That's not incriminating. I think the court, when you are concerned that there is this child that's being hidden by what they believe to be the mother, and they believe that it was there was some kind of abuse and neglect going on, it was perfectly acceptable. And the determination of her right to appointed counsel, which is this other prong, by law, by statute, occurs at the protective custody hearing. So the law contemplates that you're not going to have counsel.
But of course, our purpose here is not whether the judge is in trouble for holding the hearing or anybody else, but whether she can be convicted of perjury thereafter, where she was denied counsel at that hearing, which is a different question. We can honor all the points you make about the safety of the child and the court's concern for the child. That doesn't answer that question.
Well, that's where the balance is struck in this particular case. And their argument might have a little more moxie if I still believe that she has to invoke her right not to incriminate herself. That's what the U.S. Supreme Court has said. It's up to the witness to do that. Everyone knows to take the fifth.
Now, what about your opponent's argument that State v. Caperton from our court is more on point?
Well, that case is almost 100 years old, and it came at a time before witnesses were allowed to invoke their Fifth Amendment right in front of a grand jury. At that time, you get called before a grand jury, you have to give answers. You don't get to say, you know, I choose not to answer that question, because you could be held in contempt and held in jail for as long until you purge the contempt. After that, the U.S. Supreme Court in several cases came along and said, no, a witness has the right to invoke the Fifth Amendment. And that's why Caperton really doesn't doesn't apply here.
In Caperton, the person was asking the grand jury a question that required them to admit guilt of a crime that was being investigated.
Right. And like I said, in this case, there was no crime being investigated. And as I was saying before, maybe their argument would have a little bit more force if she had been asked questions to prove elements of a criminal offense. Ask questions about, did she personally abuse and neglect this child? Then maybe that might be something that could be argued. I still think you have to show on the suppression end of it, is there a ground for suppressing? And there's no constitutional ground in this case for suppressing this. And the U.S. Supreme Court has said in Lassiter, you do not have the right to appointed counsel in a child termination proceeding. And in later in Turner against Rogers, you do not have the right to appointed counsel in any civil proceeding that's not going to directly result in your own incarceration. So while she had the right to...
What was she told about perjury at the hearing? What was she told when she testified about whether she lied? It could be used. She could be prosecuted for perjury.
I don't.
Because she was told it was just temporary. What do we know about what she understood?
We don't. I don't know if the word perjury was used, but she was told that if you have this child, if this is your child, and you have been ordered by the juvenile court to produce this child, and you don't do it, and you're telling us that you don't have one, that you know you could be held in contempt, that you could be subject to criminal charges, not for anything she said, but for the refusal to obey the order of a juvenile court, which in Chapter 211 is a Class A misdemeanor.
Did she testify on her oath, or was she given the oath?
She was given the oath, and she chose to perjure herself. She didn't give incriminating testimony that was about a previous act she committed that was then charged in a later criminal case. The act here, the criminal act, was telling a lie before court after being given the oath.
Can you address opposing counsel's argument in her brief that if you correct the lie in the same proceeding, in the course of the same proceeding, then it's not perjury, and that as soon as she was able to get counsel, she came back in and corrected her lie?
You have to, it involves making a statement, and it involves before the falsehood is discovered. She walks in the door with the child, the falsehood is discovered, there was no, and it involves...
So if she hid the child behind her, then she wouldn't have been guilty of perjury, but because you could see the child?
No, she's guilty of perjury because the statement implies a recantation. If you look at the definitions and the dictionary definitions, a recantation, in effect, before the tribunal in a proceeding under oath that you are taking back.
Does it say that under oath, that it has to be under oath that you recant?
It doesn't say that directly, but the
way... Are there cases that say that?
No.
Okay,
but the way,
if we don't need to be under oath, or are there other things that... If we... I understand your argument, it should have to be under oath. If this court doesn't choose to impose that as a new requirement, are there other requirements that were not met also, or would she then...
She didn't make a statement. She didn't make a statement.
She came in and said, here's the child.
Well, and in the brief, we set out that that's insufficient under the way the perjury statute...
Is every situation, for example, the Amerine case, where the Mr. Amerine was convicted of murder, was on death row, and the witnesses at the trial recanted their testimony. Are they not guilty of perjury too at that point? And it's affidavits, they do affidavits.
Well, I haven't thought about that one, Your Honor.
So every time someone recants testimony, even though after thoughtfulness they say, well, this guy's on death row, I should change my testimony, they're guilty of perjury also.
In that particular case, that might be deemed this recantation, but then again, that
is an exception for recantation on perjury?
Well, you can raise it as a defense during the course of the proceedings that you make a statement acknowledging the falsehood, and bringing a child to a meeting in a family service office this doesn't qualify.
More importantly, she did not claim in the trial court when she was tried for this that she had recanted it by that conduct.
That defense was never raised. She fully admitted at trial, yes, this was a lie. I committed perjury, and understand why I did it, and don't punish me. So,
and that's with counsel. That's with counsel.
And that was with counsel.
You know, what's interesting is there are two oaths that we actually give in the state of Missouri. One we give to people who will swear to tell the truth, the whole truth, talk about the truth, self them God, help you God. The other one is to people who will not swear because of religious beliefs. And we actually advise them in that oath that they're subject to the penalties of perjury.
That's correct, Your Honor.
So the oath she took was the traditional oath in this case, though.
I believe that's right.
Thank you, counsel.
It would be true that the witness in Caperton was given the same oath, I would imagine, and this court still held that because he was uncounseled and not told of his privilege, that his statement, his perjured statement, was involuntary. And unless this court overrules that case, I believe it's bound by it. U.S. versus Mondwano is not a bright-line test, and many of the justices excluded from contemplation this situation, where a defendant is summoned, or a putative defendant is summoned and subjected to the cruel trilemma without counsel, without warning. His statements are involuntary and should be suppressed. And Caperton.
So should we add to the traditional oath that you're also subject to the penalties of perjury? To help you God, subject to the penalties of perjury. Would that be sufficient?
I don't believe so, unless you also add that you have a right not to answer any questions. I think what's important is she wasn't advised that she could be silent. And Caperton is still cited today routinely. If you shepherdize it, there's a case in 2014 out of Massachusetts where it distinguishes Mondwano and Caperton and talks about the involuntary nature of a statement made under circumstances like this. And in that case, their Supreme Court actually requires now the advisement of the privilege, that you have the privilege not to incriminate yourself.
To follow up with Judge Draper's question, is it then implied that if you would say, I affirm, that you are then advised that that you'd be subject to perjury, is it assumed then by the original oath that if you take the oath, that it's up to, that you should know, or they know implicitly, that you're subject to perjury? How would they know they're subject to perjury?
They may know that they're subjected to perjury, but they do not know that they have a right to remain silent, which would obviate a perjury, you know, the necessity to be charged with perjury in the first place, which is why counsel is important, because they would have told her that she had the right not to testify, or they could have made arrangements quickly to bring the child in. And there's several reasons why the right to counsel in these cases are so important. It protects the child, not just the parent. And there's several cases out of the Eastern District which mandate that parents in juvenile court facing allegations of abuse or neglect are entitled to the same notice and opportunity to defend the charges, even at the beginning of the hearing. So, and that the trial court commits reversible error when it fails to comply with these requirements.
Counsel, would you provide us with a citation to the Massachusetts case?
Yes.
If you don't have it handy, you can do it
by letter
and copy counsel.
Okay. If there's any further questions.
Any further questions? Thank you, counsel. The matter will be taken under submission.